Holcomb still won't endorse in the governor's race. Hospital leaders feel targeted by 2023 legislation. Plus, Rokita urging National Guardsmen to the border and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 19th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb is still unwilling to say who he's endorsing in the race to replace him. The Republican primary candidates for governor are U.S. Senator Mike Braun, Fort Wayne businessman Eric Doden, and Holcomb's lieutenant governor, Suzanne Crouch. Holcomb previously said he would hold off on any endorsement until after the 2023 legislative session. Now he wants to extend that out a little further.
I am making sure that we stick the landing coming out of session. It's still May.
Holcomb insists that holding off on any endorsement isn't awkward for his governing partner, Suzanne Crouch. He says it's important for any candidate to establish that they're their own person.
I don't want anyone thinking that just because she and I work so closely together that she's a clone of me.
The 2024 gubernatorial primary is next May.
Is it awkward that Holcomb hasn't endorsed in a gubernatorial primary that includes his lieutenant governor? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Elise Schrock, I think everyone just assumes Holcomb will endorse Crouch. So at this point, is it awkward that he hasn't just done it yet?
Yeah, it's awkward. And I'm sure there's tension there. I mean, they have to work together. That's got to have some
tension. And for all we're told, work together closely.
But it's not like he has a lot of precedent for this, right? Because he became the candidate like 4 months before an election. So this is new. But
hey, but Pence endorsed him.
Sure did. There has to be some tension there. And I guess we're going to have to wait and see.
So has he kind of put himself into this position, which he could have just said, well, I'm not going to endorse anybody like this. I want it to be an open primary. I don't want to put my finger on the scale. People do that all the time. Why not do that? Or because everybody assumes you're going to endorse your running mate, why not just say, yeah, of course, she's my pick?
Well, think about just the three candidates in this primary for Republicans. What are the attack lines on each other? Pro-life, 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 pro-gun, pro-gun, pro-gun. I mean, where are you differentiating yourself in the base? And one way that I think Eric Doden and Mike Braun will try to separate from Suzanne Crouch is on the vulnerabilities that Governor Holcomb has with the Republican base, right? Coming out of COVID, we saw that play itself out at the convention last year. So I think it's prudent for Suzanne to have a little space here to go create her own identity, create her own message. She has, as we've noted previously, tacked harder to the right on some, social media and some other things. And what is Eric Holcomb? Not a far-right Republican in the primary, right? So I think she needs a little space to create her own identity or elevate her identity from what it is as auditor, as a state representative, as lieutenant governor. And if you're not strategic about when these endorsements are coming, particularly the biggest one, the sitting governor, you've just got to think about that. And is it helpful? That's a question.
Yeah.
And when is it helpful?
This is actually a question I want to ask you, John, which is, Mike just talked about, with the Republican primary base and a certain wing of the Republican primary, Eric Holcomb is not the most popular guy in the world. And this goes mostly back to COVID, I feel like. There's some other, he vetoed the trans high school sports bill last year, and he's done some other things that have angered hard-right conservatives. But is an Eric Holcomb endorsement helpful to Suzanne Crouch?
I don't think it would hurt, certainly. Still, the power of incumbency, when you have a sitting governor, yes, you do have the friction with the right wing of the party dating back to COVID and the emergency orders and a lot of sense that the governor overreached and sort of adopted a big brother approach to governance. But I mean, what are his options? Does he endorse Jennifer McCormick, the likely Democratic? I mean,
seems unlikely.
If the theory is that his endorsement is bad for the Republicans, I mean, if you really want to play multi-layer chess here, well, then he should endorse the Democrat to therefore drive people to the Republic. I mean, I think we're overthinking it. I think the easiest thing would have been to do is simply say, especially if you're uncertain or you don't want to have a lot of skin in the game or really expend a lot of capital, is just say, of course, this has been my partner in governance for X number of years. I would love to see a continuation of what we've built together. Done.
But there's a lot of people who don't want to see a continuation of what they built together, not because of record job growth and wage increases and record investment in education and roads, none of that stuff. It's
all that terrible stuff.
You shut down small business and Comrade Holcomb in the summer of 2020.
Well, and because of
Jennifer McCormick endorsement.
And if he endorses her, then you give Braun and Doden the chance to go, see, you're getting the exact same thing to that crowd, the Comrade Holcomb crowd, which is not an insane thing.
Here's the thing, though. Everyone, I feel like those attacks, let's say Holcomb never endorses anybody.
She's already going to get those,
exactly.
Right? Because she's part of that administration. Right. So I almost don't even wonder if he would endorse her, if that would hurt her, because everyone who's already against Holcomb assumes that she lines up with him on those big issues.
Or at least we'll be able to say that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think she's already going to get that bit. So, at least from the far right. So, his endorsement could hold some sway for some more moderates, though.
And to the point where, you know, because everybody just assumes that he's for her, the fact that he won't say that he is starts to feel like, well, is there a reason you don't like her? Or is there a reason you don't trust her? Which I don't think is true. I mean, it's an awkward position.
Yeah.
But I think, wouldn't it have just been better, and I'll ask you this, wouldn't it have just been better for him to go, I'm sitting this one out?
It would have been a lot less messy, I think. And I think often when you're explaining you're losing and he's kind of gotten himself into that area where he's going to have to be explaining either way more than endorsing.
What he should do is get a job as the head of a public university, take a job as the head of a public university, then check out, and then he can get out 24 altogether.
Which ones are the openings?
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, will Governor Eric Holcomb's endorsement in the gubernatorial race make an impact? A, yes, or B, no. Last week we asked you whether you were surprised that Senator Todd Young won't back Donald Trump for the GOP nomination for president. 41% said yes, 59% said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Healthcare prices in Indiana are among the highest in the nation, and Indiana lawmakers tried to address that issue in the 2023 session with a pair of bills. One of them takes aim at Indiana's largest nonprofit hospital systems. The bill's original language called for penalties if hospitals charge higher than a certain benchmark. But the version signed into law by the governor instead establishes a healthcare cost oversight task force to study a range of issues related to healthcare costs in the state and recommend ways to reduce them. The measure also requires a third-party contractor to look at the prices of Indiana's five biggest hospital systems and compare them to a new higher benchmark, 285% of what Medicare pays. Gloria Sokdev with the Employers Forum of Indiana says, nonetheless, this bill moves the needle significantly.
Well, it's the best bill we've had ever that's actually going to help reduce prices.
But hospital leaders take issue with the way the bill singles out certain hospitals. They say lawmakers are not doing enough to address the state's low Medicaid reimbursement rates, which they say drives them to raise their prices, or to address the role of insurance companies and drug makers in driving up healthcare costs. The bill also includes language to crack down on so-called facility fees that hospitals might tack onto medical bills, even if the services were provided in non-hospital settings. Mike O'Brien, will this bill actually help lower healthcare costs for Hoosiers?
If you believe the hospitals are saying, yeah. I've worked in healthcare at the state house for a long time, so I was on the payer side primarily. So just to let you know, I was pretty involved in this over the years, but what do we do in healthcare? We buy it from hospitals mostly, right? And so, like, when you're the rub with lowering healthcare costs is you're reducing or bending the or reducing the increase, what you're really doing, in the amount of money you're sending to providers. That's it. And so when the providers say this is going to hurt us, they're right. And that was the point, because we had the highest hospital costs in the country. And we had the nonprofits sitting on billions of dollars in surplus, right? That's what attracted the attention of the legislature, particularly the Speaker of the House, Todd Houston, to try to do something in this. The one issue that no one really talks about, because it's kind of technical, is hospitals for a long time, it's called, there's this concept of site of service. Like, what are you, you know, what type of facility do you have? Is it a strip mall or is it a giant hospital? And that requires a different reimbursement rate. For years, hospitals were billing at that higher rate, and the legislature came in and made that illegal. And Congress just introduced a bill this week to also make that illegal. And so I think it will. It's certainly the most significant bill they've passed. And there's some unique concepts in here. The rate cap, a huge incentive to go towards value-based arrangements with providers where they've got some skin in the game to pay for the outcome. That their, you know, whatever the patient's outcome is affects their reimbursement rate. So things like that. It was pretty creative how the House in particular and then the Senate in the second half of the session tried to tackle this. And I think they did it in a pretty big way. And if you believe the hospitals, it is going to have an impact.
So the hospitals, some of them, I think, are like, well, there's nothing wrong with our prices whatsoever. But I mean, even some hospitals are like, yeah, we need to collectively look at this. The hospital's problem seems to be you're only looking at us.
Right.
Is that the biggest issue with this legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the failings of this whole process is the fact that the hospitals were called to question, but not the insurance companies and not the pharmaceutical companies. They were not once brought to the table on this at the same rate. Hospitals also said, hey, Medicaid reimbursements are a big problem when it comes to passing on costs, and Medicaid reimbursements, which are already lagging here in Indiana, you know, they afforded some relief to practitioners, but not the hospitals.
Right.
That is a problem. So this bill has some good stuff in it, sure, moving the ball forward, but there are some ways that it's really lacking, and I don't know that because of that we're going to see, certainly not an immediate impact, but I'm not sure it's going to help in the way that people really are struggling and need that help.
We're now home, as of this week, home to the most valuable drug maker on the planet.
Yeah.
And Eli Lilly was announced this week.
Is that part of the problem? Is the fact that there are some influential insurance and drug makers here in Indiana?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were some other bills. There was a pharmacy benefit manager bill that looked
Which
at some of these
I
issues.
I want to talk about
Lilly
that more
testified,
last week. Yeah.
You know, so there were some other bills. I think all of them, if you looked at all of them as a package, they obviously started very aggressive and kind of slowly pulled back. On one hand, if the you could say in your mind, if hospitals are so scared, then it must really have an impact, right? But on the other hand, and what I heard from some lawmakers, especially in rural areas, is they're worried about, well, hospitals and providers will just say, I'm out, you know? And we already live in a state where most counties in this state don't have a hospital. So, you know, there's a fine balance between what lawmakers are trying to do.
To that end, then, because that is part of the concern here, this bill in particular really only targeted hospitals. And so it, as Nikki pointed out, and as the piece pointed out, this was a lot more aggressive. When you're talking about penalties if you exceed certain costs, that's significant. And they pulled way back from that to, well, we're going to have somebody look at them, and then we'll have this task force look at them. Did they pull back too far, or did they pull back enough to make sure that hospitals stay open?
Well, I mean, that's the big question. And keep in mind, as we've discussed before, this is not a Republican versus Democratic issue. It's much more geography-based. And is my district home to a hospital that fits this description and would be in a precarious financial position if this had been enacted as originally introduced? I mean, it's no surprise why hospitals were the target here. The surpluses that we've heard so much about,
particularly at nonprofit hospitals.
Particularly at nonprofit hospitals, but which is another point probably that makes this even more complicated. But then you look at, as you pointed out in the open, the reimbursement, I should say the cost is among the highest in the country, but physician reimbursements are among the lowest, if not the lowest. So if you look at those two factors alone, and I know there are a lot of other issues, but it's like if the doctors aren't getting the money, where's the money going? It's going into the system. Where is it coming out? So that makes it an easy target. But then the other point is that you're right. Nonprofit is not nonprofit is not nonprofit. There are those that are barely scraping by, and there are others that were in a position to give $500 million contribution to, for instance, the IU Medical School. And in trying to come up with a mechanism that encourages cost efficiency across that whole spectrum is pretty tough because they don't look alike and they don't operate alike.
And hospitals don't exist in a vacuum. The you know, healthcare field is much more vast and complicated.
I mean, and some of what leads to incredibly high healthcare costs in Indiana is we're an unhealthy state, which is partly why we're doing this huge public health push and mental health push and all that, which is good. Let me ask you one last question, Mike. Is this it? Are they going to take
Yeah.
Is this like, okay, we've done something, let's give it a few years to see what happens, or are we coming back next year?
I think this is pretty significant. I think this was a huge lift. It was a huge undertaking by a lot of legislators in both the House and the Senate and both parties. There's always something.
Yeah.
I mean, we're always nipping around the edges of one-off healthcare problems or an experience somebody had they didn't like.
I don't think we'll have a choice. I mean, we're also doing the unwinding from the COVID era Medicaid eligibility, and so
that's the next problem.
That's like be significant.
Medicaid eligibility tightening up after COVID is going to leave.
But that argument you made is the same one that hospitals advanced at the beginning of this session, saying we're waiting for some of the earlier prescriptive measures that were imposed earlier to bear fruit. We're not there yet. So they already were making that argument even before this legislation was enacted.
All right. Attorney General Todd Rokita told Wish TV this week that Governor Eric Holcomb should join a few other Republican governors in sending National Guard and law enforcement personnel and resources to the country's southern border. Texas Governor Greg Abbott recently sent a letter to the nation's governors requesting support in immigration enforcement after the Biden administration lifted Title 42, a pandemic-era policy that had shut down almost all avenues for migrants to seek asylum in the U.S. Holcomb and 23 other governors recently signed on to a statement from the Republican Governors Association supporting Abbott's efforts on the border.
Nikki Kelly, a statement supporting Texas that a lot of governors signed on to is one thing. Personnel and resources are an entirely different thing. What does Holcomb do here?
Well, right now they're standing pat. I reached out to the governor's office this week and asked, and they said, look, we have had 22 National Guard members down there for maybe the last year as part of a smaller issue.
And that's a federal mission.
Correct. That's part of a federal mission, and so they weren't even really in charge of that order. But and right now they don't have any plans to do more. I think he's in a tight position on that one because other states are starting to react and send down there. And Todd Rokita especially is making it a little hard for the governor.
Would making this decision, let's not pretend that politics never enters the governor's mind when making a decision, as much as he might say otherwise sometimes. But is it making it easier here for Eric Holcomb that he's not running for anything in 2024? At least not as far as we're aware. So the politics here don't impact him nearly as much.
They probably don't impact him as much as those individuals who are running and are trying to advance the narrative that there is a crisis, an unprecedented crisis on our southern borders, and that, you know, this is a threat to our very democracy and our existence, which most accounts suggest that that's not the case. There's another big problem here about the legality of these individuals. Now, you can't use, generally speaking, guard individuals, men and women, in a law enforcement role. And some states have said, well, we won't send our National Guard troops. We'll send state troopers or we'll send criminal investigators. Well, there's no certainty that they have any legal authority in the state of Texas. And in fact, there is a pretty large contingent of legal scholarship that suggests that if they do try to make arrests of people that are crossing the border and so forth, they could be subject to, you know, wrongful arrest or essentially confined, kidnap. Yeah, legal challenges that for an improper arrest where they have no authority. And because of that, and Texas, I think, even recognizes that. You had Ohio State troopers, I believe, in the past year that essentially, because of this issue, were cleaning out the horse stables, the manure in the horse stables that the Border Patrol agents use. So I guess that arguably frees up agents to clean out manure in the barns, but it's not as if they're going down to be the front line vanguard of defending
manure
our borders.
Manure in the barns. let me ask this question, because I think the average person thinks of the National Guard and law enforcement very, very differently. Like, we often see the Indiana National Guard being sent to other states to help with disaster recovery and things like that. That's an important function that the National Guard plays across the country. So sending them down to Texas to do something, I think to the average Hoosier would go, well, okay, we send the National Guard down to other states all the time. Sending Indiana police to another state and theoretically then taking them away from Indiana and protecting people here at home, is that a good idea?
That's a consequence of doing that, for sure. But I think Todd Rokita has a point.
Wow. That hasn't been said on the show in a
while. Go on.
This has changed drastically in 4 years. April of 2020, there were 17,000 border crossings at the southern border. April of 2023, there were 211,000. And so the argument that why would Indiana ever do that? That's an Arizona problem. That's a Texas problem. The argument is this is starting to affect all major metropolitan cities as the sheer volume of the migration coming in. They're not all going to El Paso, right? They're going everywhere. And so I'm not saying that we should send national for that reason, right? It depletes resources here, but it does bring into focus that this is a national problem. This isn't a southern border state problem anymore.
And it has been, and we've needed immigration reform for a very long time. And the fact that the notion that these types of immigrants coming in and people who need to seek asylum and who are looking for a better life is everyone's problem is not a Todd Rokita thing.
It's a Western Hemisphere
collective
problem.
Yeah.
Right? We have a humanitarian crisis.
But I don't want to get out of this topic without asking this question, and I'll ask this to you. A lot of this attention right now is because Title 42 ended. Now, you can feel one way or the other about whether or not that policy should have been in place this whole time or whether it should still be in place. But it ended. You are seeing a greater influx of migrants. Some people think that's a good thing. If you're an asylum seeker, we should be able to give you shelter. Is this a huge failing of the Biden administration to not at least be more visibly responding to what is clearly a crisis?
I think every administration over the last couple of decades that has failed to move the conversation forward or pass immigration reform has failed. And it is a critique that you will hear of the administration from my community, the Hispanic and Latino community. So we need to do more. Back to the question at hand, is sending our state resources down to some Yosemite Sam mission by a Texas governor? The answer, probably not. And I think, there's a lot of fear-mongering when it comes to this issue that happens in our state and that a lot of people have bought into. But it's usually like a political statement. It's not like actually sending our resources. And that's where I think the difference in the conversation is.
A national problem and federal problem are not synonymous. That's why we don't have states sending up their helicopters to try to intercept Chinese surveillance balloons.
Right.
The federal government does.
This
won't happen for political reasons, but what if a president who is a commander-in-chief tells a National Guard unit to do something other than, which is when you have a constitutional crisis.
Sure.
That's why, generally speaking, this is the federal domain. I mean, traditionally.
Yeah. It just feels to me, again, I don't know what the Biden administration is doing here. And I think that's a real problem. Maybe they're doing something. But I don't think we know what that is. And that in and of itself is part. I mean, yes, there's a lot of politics going on here. But if a bunch of people, even in conservative states, saw the federal government actually trying to address this issue in a more significant way to respond to the significant, I'm going to call it a crisis. I think it's a crisis. Whether or not these people should be here or not, it's a crisis. And so without them doing something more visible, it just feels like, well, it leaves the door open for folks to go, well, we have to do something.
And it is the continuation of a very dangerous political discourse that it is heaped on top of that.
Yeah. Well, finally, the state unveiled some new highway signs this week, welcoming people to Indiana. The new signs incorporate the state's current tourism campaign in Indiana by reading, "More to discover in Indiana." Mike O'Brien, What's your in Indiana pitch for the highway welcome sign? Because Morning Discovery is not bad, but
race in Indiana.
I like that, especially since we're doing it ahead of the 500. What's your in Indiana pitch?
I mean, I'm going to try and not make the joke about going backwards in time, but it's really hard to. Yeah. That's kind of where I'm going.
Yeah, that tourism campaign. Mm-hmm. Brought up a lot of that from a lot of people.
Yeah, I only have things I can't say publicly. like all that's flooding in my mind are very inappropriate things.
Yeah, that was the struggle with the End Indiana campaign.
I'd say, take it all in, a lot can happen in an Indiana mile.
Oh.
Would they have to pay us for that?
That's why I'm suggesting.
All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.